In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
And welcome once again to another edition of Strange Planet. Thanks, as always, for sticking me in your ears. On this episode, a documentary filmmaker shares more than three decades of research into the afterlife and paranormal phenomena. And we're going to get into some promising avenues of what he calls post-materialist scientific investigations that are currently underway. Daniel Drazen is a writer, media producer, and pioneering documentary filmmaker. His groundbreaking 1961 documentary, Sunday, the first social protest film of the 1960s, is part of the permanent collection at New York's Museum of Modern Art and is still in demand at international film festivals. His three decades of research into afterlife communication have culminated in two feature documentaries, Calling Earth and Skoll. The Afterlife Experiment, his first book on the subject, A New Science of the Afterlife, was completed on his 80th birthday in September 2022, and that's out, released in June this month. Daniel, welcome to Strange Planet. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Richard.
And let me say, first of all, if I might, for those watching video, I cannot believe that you celebrated your 80th birthday. Whatever you're doing, keep doing it. You're in
doing it right.
Good health.
Well, I've been blessed with good genes, so I'll keep doing that.
Excellent. Yes, good genes help for
Don't
sure.
Let those go. Thank you.
All right. You write about how we are entering into a post-materialist era. First, I guess we need a little bit of a crash course in what materialism means. And of course, you dedicate the first part of the book to Materialism 101. But just what are the major tenets of materialism?
Well, materialism basically says that all of reality is based in matter, that there's nothing beyond matter. Now, matter is a sort of a shorthand for matter, energy, space, and time. But our materialist perspective focuses us on the matter part. And that's why we say materialism. Basically, it's the idea that the whole of reality is mechanistic. It's made up of little parts that you can dissect into smaller parts, into smaller parts, into smaller parts, that these parts are entirely mechanistic, deterministic. There's no originality, no creativity, no actual perception or experience. And that somehow, when all these little parts and building blocks get together and rub elbows, they can produce all this magical stuff, like living things. And when you really look deeply into it, you don't find much there. You just find more and more and more mechanistically predictable elements. And what we're beginning to realize now is that there's a whole other part of reality, part of nature, if you will. We'll get into the semantics later of things like supernatural and paranormal. But nature as a whole appears to incorporate much, much more, certainly more than meets the eye, as it were, meets our senses. And we talk about the veil and what's on the other side of the veil. But what is the veil? The veil is our senses. It's the limitations of our senses. We know that there are hundreds, thousands of radio and TV broadcasts and wireless communications going through the space around us and through our bodies at all times. But it doesn't exist. It's totally non-existent until we bring something into the picture that can resonate with a particular frequency, right?
Right.
So whether this is analogous or literally true, and I suspect it's literally true, what we're dealing with in the notion of the afterlife or the greater reality is basically a higher frequency than the frequencies of what we call the material world. I mean, you strike a piano string and it vibrates hundreds of times per second. You look at an oxygen molecule and vibrates at millions of times per second. Look at light, visible light, operates at quadrillion times per second. So what's beyond that? And my personal speculation and that of others is that what we call the greater reality or the afterlife or the domain of consciousness is basically a much higher frequency domain.
Right.
And it can only interact with our slower, more gross physical universe through sensitive neurological and biological structures. Right. So our consciousness, which from a material point of view is totally abstract.
Yeah. They don't that's a tricky wicket for the materialists, isn't it? Consciousness. Right. They don't want to go there.
Right. Well, they call consciousness an epiphenomenon. Which means an illusion. Mm. Now, to what or to whom the illusion is appearing is never asked.
Right. It's just an illusion neurological functioning
itself. Right.
They just consider it neurological functioning.
Right. Basically, that's it. And then, you know, when we are relieved of our bodies, the ends of our lives, that's it. You know, we're destined to the dustbin of physical decay, and that's that. But the problem is that there's just too much evidence now, and this has been building up for many decades, probably longer than that. Mm. But in terms of the modern scientific area of afterlife investigation, since at least the 1970s or so, when the phenomenon of the near-death experience was finally acknowledged, been going on forever, of course. But in modern times, it was really only acknowledged and studied toward the end of the 20th century. And folks like Ken Ring and Moody and others, finally put the NDE on the map. And of course, the skeptics came out of the woodwork and said, "Oh, it's nothing but the results of anesthesia or sleep apnea.
An oxygen-starved brain. An oxygen-starved brain.
Right, yeah. Right. And I'm not quite sure who had the most oxygen-starved brains in those debates, but."
When you talk many scientists, obviously, many scientists are materialists. But as you point out in the book, materialism isn't science. What's the difference?
Well, science is a method of inquiry. Materialism is a belief system about reality. That's basically the difference. And, you know, whether all scientists are materialists is, to me, an open question, because I think when you speak to people privately who may have a public investment in their self-image and their reputation, you get them privately, very often their minds will be very much more open than they might appear. And this is true of a lot of people who've had what we call paranormal experiences. But paranormality is sort of a social definition. We don't know how normal or abnormal or paranormal a given phenomenon is if we can't talk about it. That's beginning to change now, but I think we still have a ways to go. There's still a great deal of sort of organized skepticism, which I call pseudo-skepticism in my book, because it's not skepticism of the healthy kind. You switch on your TV and surf the net and you'll see plenty of skeptics being trotted out to debunk this or that aspect of post-materialist science. And I think that's on the wane, but we have a ways to go there. The popular media still kind of needs to hew to the party line on this. I think some things are helping to change this. The recent UFO UAP revelations, for example, are helping to give a more of an official imprimatur to something which so many other people already have taken for granted for so many years. I certainly have, and that was actually one of my first clues. Even as a child, I was interested in the UFO issue. I had experienced quite a number of precognitive dreams as a child, and so I suspected very early on that in the theater of life, stuff goes on backstage that we're not directly privy to.
Absolutely.
And then when the first really real public information started coming out about the UFO question in the late 40s, I started reading everything I could get my hands on, which wasn't very much at the time, and became an investigator as well. I worked with John Keel on the Mothman investigation in West Virginia, which was fascinating, utterly fascinating experience, and in which I had several interesting, inexplicable experiences myself.
Can I just stop you there a minute for one moment, Daniel, because you mentioned Keel.
Yeah.
And there is an interesting parallel. I don't know if this happened at the same time. I think it was in the late 60s. You met the friend of a friend. His name was Joe. You later, both of you, you and the friend, discovered later that the Joe you met had died 2 years previous. Is that, because John Keel also tells a story of someone coming to his apartment, having a lengthy conversation. They went out to lunch. He spent the whole afternoon with him. He later learned that individual had died, I don't know, months or years prior.
It was at least 2 years before that. And that individual was John Keel, a friend of mine.
Ah.
Wow. And it was I who met Joe at John's apartment that night.
Oh,
and that was
wow.
What was the night that the bridge went down in Point Pleasant?
Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah. And we actually, a little backstory on that. on John's previous trip to Point Pleasant, he had been told by a psychic in the town that, quote, there would be a disaster on the river the night that President Johnson lights the White House Christmas tree. That was literally what he was told. So on that evening, John and I were both back in New York where we lived. And I went up to John's place briefly just to check in with him, whether he'd heard anything. And that's where I met Joe. Joe had shown up that evening and he was there with John. He was this big guy, taller than I am. And I'm like 6'1". Mm-hmm. He had, was well-built, had a mustache, dark hair, and a very firm handshake. That was the thing that somehow impressed me most about him, this very, very firm handshake. So we turned on the TV. We watched Johnson light the White House Christmas tree. And then John and Joe went out to dinner. I went back home, turned my TV on just in time for the news bulletin to come through that the bridge had collapsed in Point Pleasant. So it was only later that it was, a year or two later that John, oh, and by the way, yes, John and Joe went out to dinner. They went to a UFO conference that was being presented that evening. And subsequently, Joe disappeared. John couldn't find him. Phone had been disconnected, which it had been actually for some time before that. And so John was puzzled. 2 years later, John runs into Joe's wife in Macy's in New York and says, you know, oh, how's Joe doing? And she says, oh, I'm sorry you didn't know. Joe passed away 3 years ago, whatever it was. And John said, well, no, I saw him 2 years ago. His wife said, don't mess with me, John. Please, I was with him when he passed, all that. And so John was kind of, you know, blindsided by that. And, I've read about these materializations. I'd never experienced one before and didn't know it was happening when I met Joe. But I have to say it was, assuming that's what it was seamless. There was nothing about him that said, I'm dead. So, and of course, you know, there's literature about this. And of course, during the Skoll experiment,
Let's talk
in the 1990s, yeah. This was an experiment in physical mediumship that was conducted by two couples. One couple were both mental mediums, channelers, and the other couple were researchers. And they sat twice a week for 5 years, experimenting with communicating with a team on the other side who worked with them. They sort of worked from both sides to create experiments that would produce tangible evidence on the physical side.
You say a team from the other side, you mean literally a spirit, a team of spirits on the other
right,
side.
They called them the spirit team.
Right.
Which was organized by a Victorian lady named Emily Bradshaw, who was one of many folks on the other side who spoke through the mediums. They produced, as you've seen my film, I think, Skoll, the Afterlife Experiment. Mm-hmm. And if your viewers would like to see it, it's there's a simple link for it. It's bit.ly/skollmovie, one word. bit.ly/skollmovie. Runs 80 minutes and it gets into a lot of detail about the experiment. When my co-producer Tim Coleman and I visited the Skoll folks and filmed them, interviewed them, they showed us this wonderful collection of objects that had appeared on their table in their seance room.
Apports.
The apports, yes. They're called apports because they're said to actually have existed physically somewhere and then were apported in the French influenced lingo of physical mediumship into the room. And they would, the room itself was virtually in darkness, which they were instructed to set up that way by the spirit team, although to avoid any kind of fakery or sleight of hand, everyone wore dimly luminous bracelets on their wrists. All movable objects in the room had these luminous tabs on them. The table was designed so there you couldn't do any hanky-panky under the table.
Right. And other journalists and skeptics and scientists were also invited to sit in?
Yes, absolutely. And at least one professional magician who testified that he was unable to find anything in the way of paraphernalia or setups of any kind. Excuse me. So my favorite item that was apported was a newspaper. It was published during the war years, early 1940s, and appeared on their table one night or one day. And I held this paper in my hand and leafed through it. And while this is about 5 years after it had appeared, and while the outer pages had begun to yellow, which would be expected of an old newspaper, the inner pages were white as if the thing had just come off the press. And it was dated 1945, and it was, obviously a paper of that era. You can see it in my film. And it was quite an experience, just again, and like the materialized Joe, there was nothing unusual about this paper. It was a perfectly physical, ordinary object, except that it had been somehow brought through time, I suppose.
Full-on apparitions as well?
They had a variety of apparitions. They had voices of the spirit team and others just come right out of the air, not through the mouths of the mediums. There were partial materializations of hands, for example, that would touch people. A lot of testimony about that. They set up some experiments, some photographic experiments, for example.
These are fascinating.
They were asked to put an ordinary film camera with a roll of color film in it on the table. The camera was heard to levitate around the room with the shutter clicking, and then it landed back on the table. And when the film was developed, there were 11 black and white, perfectly framed black and white photos on this roll of film. And they were told that some of these were literal copies of photos that existed somewhere in the world.
Right.
And they were actually able to track down some of these originals, not all of them. Later, they were asked to simply put rolls of film on the table. And these were, while the experiment was under scrutiny, these rolls of film were kept in locked boxes that were held by the investigators. And if the spirit team felt that they had produced something on the film, they were asked to develop the film, which they were able to do in-house. They had a special processing machine there. And the films contain an enormous variety of interesting things, drawings, whimsical designs, puzzles, poetry. A poem by William Wordsworth was a variation on one of his more famous poems. They also experimented with some electronic voice, using a cheap consumer tape recorder, using its amplifier.
EVPs, yeah.
And when they inquired about how to improve the results they were getting, they were asked to put a roll of film on the table. When the film was developed, it had a diagram on it showing how the device was to be improved. And it was signed TAE. In what turned out to be essentially a replica of Thomas Alva Edison's signature or initials.
Unbelievable. Pardon the interruption. I got to take a quick time out. We'll come back and continue to discuss a new science of the afterlife. Daniel Drazen stays with us.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Daniel Drazen is with me, and the new book is A New Science of the Afterlife, Space, Time, and the Consciousness Code. And we were talking about the Skoll experiments. I interrupted you to go to a break. We were talking about a set of instructions that appeared to be signed by Thomas Alva Edison.
Right. And we know that Edison himself at one point was interested in afterlife communication, and he proposed building some kind of a device to facilitate it. And he passed away before he was able to finish that project. But it was something that did interest him. He had a relatively mechanistic view of the afterlife, and which kind of tweaked his imagination, and that was fine. But he did have an interest in it, and this has been the object of a lot of skeptical ridicule and that sort of thing. But I think his desire was genuine to move science and technology at least in the direction of recognizing a greater reality. And I think that was its value, and that of other things which may or may not be. I mean, for example, you know about Gary Schwartz's work. He's in Arizona. He's been connected with the University of Arizona, and he is working on a project which he calls the Soul Phone, which he hopefully will create a device that will be as reliable and repeatable as an ordinary telephone to speak to the other side. And, you know, I don't know whether I'm not saying yes or no. I don't know whether it's possible to achieve that degree of reliable communication. I think there are various levels of challenge involved in bringing these two realms together. I think there are some that are time variant. Some people claim that communication through electronics works best during the waxing phase of the moon. I haven't checked that out myself, but there's an inconsistency about it that suggests that we don't know the mechanics of it. We just know that it works, it happens. Some people use it as a practical means of communicating with their departed loved ones. I'm not clear as to how much the person's latent mediumship ability is connected with that. There has not been enough organized research on these aspects of it. And organized research takes time. It takes money. There is one study going on in Canada it just began recently with Professor Imance Barouche at what's the university? It's near Toronto. I'm trying to think of its name. Oh, I can look it up.
There's York University, the University of Toronto.
Hold on one second. I can tell you in a moment. Anyway, it's a study. Hold on. In London, Ontario.
Western University.
Yes.
University of Western Ontario.
He has been funded to do research on instrumental transcommunication through smartphones. A lot of people have been receiving texts and voice messages from their departed loved ones. And from what I understand, even some of the people involved in the study themselves have begun to receive some of these messages.
Well, that's
so I'm not sure, you know, what controls are being applied or exactly how it's being done. All I know is that this is a study that's underway. It started relatively recently.
I will look into that study because, and I've talked about this on my podcast. I've talked about it on Coast to Coast AM. Mm-hmm. I received a call from a colleague of mine after he died. And it's, you know, kind of a long involved story, but the day after the phone call, and I learned about his passing on Coast to Coast AM. Someone was talking about it, and I checked the recents on my phone, you know, that keeps a log of all your outgoing and ingoing calls. the call, our Gary Patterson called me on a Friday night. There was no record of anyone calling me on Friday night. No incoming calls, no outgoing calls. And my wife corroborated. I was on the phone with Gary. I said, am I misremembering this? Was that two nights ago? No, it was last night. And I later learned at his funeral, he died earlier in the day. I received a call from him. It was, well, it was dark here in May, which means it was probably, 9 o'clock, and he died at 5 o'clock. So there wow. Anyway, I'm sorry I interrupted, but I thought,
I'm glad to hear anyone's experiences. We're so oriented towards our world and the people and the objects we relate to on a day-to-day basis. That's our reality. When we go to the other side, it's different. Time is different. Space is different. In my book, I take a stab at trying to describe in words, although I also say it's impossible to describe in words, because there's a lot about semantics in the book. And how words can be misleading.
Yeah, or just are simply not. I like that you describe language as pointing a finger at the moon. I guess that's a Zen expression.
Right.
You're pointing a finger at the moon. That's not the moon, but that's right. Language, right? That's what we attempt to do with language.
Right. And a particular language has its own strengths and weaknesses and its own. Places where it works well and work and doesn't, or works very, very poorly. People who are bilingual, if you listen to people who are bilingual, they'll very often switch from one language to another in order to best express certain kinds of things. So language is relative. It's the chapter in my book on language is called Don't Eat the Menu. Don't mistake the word for the reality.
Yes,
you got to cut language a lot of slack, and to try as much as possible to move your experience into a place where you are more directly or intuitively appreciating what it is where that finger is pointing to, and different people will have different ways of doing that. Everyone's we each are in our own universe.
We're prisoners.
You and I could agree. Pardon?
We're prisoners, really, of our senses.
Right. Not only our senses, but our experience, our orientation in life, our upbringing, our culture.
True.
It all these things frame what reality is for us. You and I could be sitting at a table, and we can agree that we're sitting at a table, but I have no idea how you perceive that table, let alone what associations you might have with it. For whatever reason. So I think the more we understand that we each create our own reality or our own sense of reality, I think the more respect we have for one another and the more patient we can be with one another, because I don't know what goes on inside of anyone else. You can be partnered with someone for years and there may be whole big areas of their reality that you never realize.
Is it? I think it's your quote in the book, or you're referencing someone else saying, that yes, we have our own perceptions, we have our own version of reality, and if you disagree with me, you've proven my point.
Right,
yes, Daniel. Another exactly. Quick timeout. Daniel Drazen, A New Science of the Afterlife, Space, Time, and the Consciousness Code.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. We're now crossing a zone of turbulence. Please return your seats and food trays to their upright position and make sure your carry-on luggage is safely stowed. You're about to leave everything you know behind. This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Strange Planet.
And this is Daniel Drazen's new book, A New Science of the Afterlife, Space, Time, and the Consciousness Code. And you were about to give us kind of a landscape of the afterlife as best you could. And then we got into a discussion about language and how language simply isn't, our language isn't equipped to create these landscapes in our mind. But let's take a shot at it.
Well, in the book, I speculate that the so-called afterlife, the other side, the greater reality, is not just a higher frequency carbon copy of physical reality. It has its own set of characteristics. It's more fluid. It is self-determining in that it is made out of consciousness. That's its substance. And that unlike the sort of hard-coded space and time frameworks we have here in the physical, things are more flexible there. And that you might think of the other side as a hologram of infinite extent that is not spatial or temporal in the sense that we perceive it. For example, we are told that when we pass over, oftentimes we are met by our dead relatives.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And they present to us in a way that's recognizable to us. Some may present as we remember them in their later years. Some may present as a younger self. So are they literally out there in space putting on a costumed self, as it were, appearance? Or are they simply projecting a form that appears in our consciousness?
Right.
I think that's how it works. So we shouldn't be too eager to project how our physical world works onto the mechanics of the afterlife. When people cross over, they say they're often taken to a very beautiful place like a garden, where they relax and get oriented and may meet friends and counselors and so on. And they are told that, you know, if you reach down and touch the grass, it will feel exactly like you expect grass to feel. But it's all made out of consciousness. And by the same token, you can say that everything in our physical world is made out of consciousness.
Yes.
It's just that it's slowed down
into matter.
Sort of it's gelled or imprisoned, you might say. But the idea is that we still have perception, we still have memory, we don't have a sense of linear time as we have it here, but we retain the sense of subjective time that we have here. I mean, we in our everyday lives, what we experience is subjective time.
Right.
We can look at a clock and we can get a sense of the passage of objective time, but it's subjective time that's always with us. And we take that with us when we pass over, apparently. And you know, it goes faster when we're having fun, and it slows down when we're bored or frustrated, you know.
Right.
But in the afterlife, we are told we can master these experiences and be in control of them and learn how to create both individual and collective realities that can be quite beautiful and harmonious and can be wonderful learning experiences and experiences of sharing information and lifetimes of learning. So it's a larger framework.
It sounds an awful lot like lucid dreaming.
Well, lucid dreaming, as far as I can tell, is sort of a kindergarten of the afterlife. It's an opportunity to experience and practice some of the inner motions and actions and activities that we'd be practicing full time on the other side. Lucid dreaming allows us to practice creation, a coherent creation, if that's what we want to do. To have experiences of our choice and to be aware that that's what it is, to not mistake them for the type of experiences we have in physical reality, to have that experience of being in the greater reality where the rules are a little bit different. Now, I've had personally a couple of spontaneous lucid dreams. And so I can speak with some direct experience of it. It was quite remarkable. I've also had a couple of dreams in which I've experienced a healing energy. It was one period of time where I had problems with my back. And I had a dream in which I was healed with some kind of an infusion of energy in my back. And it was so powerful that it woke me up. And that energy continued physically in my back for at least 5 minutes.
Wow.
And that was quite an experience. I also, I had a dream in which a recently deceased friend of mine showed up. And it was funny. I was in the dream, I was like hovering over a long corridor. It was, imagine like a corridor between underground corridor between two airline terminals, with crowds of people going both ways. So I'm kind of hovering over this and watching these crowds of people. And in the crowd, I see this woman who's a friend of mine who had recently passed. And as she approaches me, she looks up at me and she says, "Dan." And I look down and say, "Anna." And she sent this blast of what I can only call heart energy out to me in this dream. And it was so powerful that it woke me up. And that energy, I could feel physically in my body for some minutes afterwards.
Wow.
So these are among the experiences that tell me that, I mean, if your physical experience is the ultimate arbiter of reality, mm-hmm. Then those really hit the jackpot for me. That there's something really real going on there, that, you know, real beings that I was connecting with on the other side, or whatever you want to call it, were interacting with me in this wonderful way. So
it is remarkable. Is there I'm trying to think of the term. I think it's synesthesia, where you might smell a color. Some people have this ability. They smell a color. They can hear. They might be able to hear a color. I believe you write about this in the book. There is a little bit of that, perhaps, in the afterlife, or there is a lot of that in the afterlife.
Well, I don't know whether it's possible to say, because, again, you and I, being different individuals, your vision might be like hearing to me.
Right.
And there's no way to know.
True.
So again, it throws into doubt all prejudice we have about other people, about where they're coming from, what their experience is. And, you know, particularly in this time of schism and divisiveness, I think it's so important to keep that in mind. And that even, you know, the people with whom we might radically disagree, from their point of view, they're perfectly right, you know. And so to me, the solution to this conundrum is dialogue.
Right.
Dialogue, honest debate, just bring the stuff out, you know, without prejudice, without being accusative. Just, you know, this is my experience. What's your experience? Let's just look at this. And when it comes, you know, the political schisms and all the pro-vax, anti-vax stuff. Mm-hmm. If the factions there could only have gotten together, compared notes, respectfully,
yes,
shared information, asked questions, we could have avoided a lot of pain.
So true. Mm-hmm. And a greater understanding of what death really means, as you point out in the book, ultimately can lead to a new understanding of what life is all about, and suddenly all of those ephemeral differences become quite meaningless. A New Science of the Afterlife, Space, Time, and the Consciousness Code And how do we get a copy?
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, the usual places online. You can go to Amazon and just type in my name, Daniel Drazen. It's my only book, and that'll take you right to the page.
All right. And I'll put the link will be in the episode description. And of course, the documentary Skoll, the Afterlife Experiment, that's bit.ly/
Skoll Movie.
Skoll Movie.
Right. And, and the other documentary, which is called Calling Earth, which is about electronic communication with the other side, that's bit.ly/CallEarth, one word, Call Earth. And that'll get you there. And that's a 95-minute documentary about afterlife communication through electronics.
Daniel, a great delight meeting you and speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Likewise, Richard. Thank you. Hope we can do it again sometime.
We will.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.